Good evening. So we're here tonight to discuss poaching, and as already been mentioned, what is poaching? Is that boiling an egg? So does anyone have a definition of poaching? What would we possibly have to say about that?
So it's not just stealing? There's clearly a angle to it?
Yes. Yes, that is true. So my definition of poaching is when a third party inserts him or herself into some kind of transaction between two people who are coming to an agreement but have not necessarily finalized it. Is that all that the legal scrutiny counsel? I made that up.
I don't know the official legal definition of poaching. I mean, conceptually, usually think of poaching as like, you poach employees. And that's a term that's usually used, frequently used.
Okay. So right off the bat, it occurred to me that there really is no good English word for this action. Right? Possible synonyms are to steal or to infringe. And poach is related to the word poke. When in doubt, look up etymology. So
that's
kind of
official English. We're interested in whatever the Hebrew word is.
That is true also. And there really isn't a term for it in Hebrew, as you will see in a moment. But it made me think that it's a weird intermediary action, right? So if you're doing a transaction, on one hand, the transaction is completed, it's good, it's legal, right? You bought or sold something. And on the other end of the spectrum, you steal. You take something that's not yours, the transaction's not legal. But poaching is in the middle. And there's no good word for it, I think. And it's very hard to characterize, and as such, it's also very hard to punish. So these were my thoughts about this. So there is a Jewish concept for this activity, and I put it right up front, and it's called Ani Hamechapek V'Charara, which literally is translated many different ways. That's the theme tonight. Everything is kind of vague. And it's literally translated as a poor person turns their cake, which is not quite right because charara is, the Hebrew word means to perforate. Actually to poke, now that I think of it. So it's a sense of having a cake and turning it over. Now, I put down some alternative translations. The poor turn in the heat. The poor of the revolution is in distress. I hear a note. So, the full quote of this about poaching is that a poor person turns their cake and another comes and takes it. And the person who took it is called a rasha, a wicked person. Why? Because did the person who interjected, who poached, do something illegal? It's a rhetorical question. Lawrence, you don't have to answer that. But that's kind of the way we're going with all of this. So while one is in the process of negotiating for a particular property, another person frequently enters the process with a more attractive bid, snatching the property away from the first party. In the Talmud, this action is known as Ani Hamechapek B'Charara, and in the view of Jewish law, this person does not do a crime, but this person is considered wicked, rasha. So that's the premise that's going to run through all of this. So having said that, we're going to explore the concept of poaching in three different areas of life, and they are business, dating, and employment. So first we'll start with business, and we have a text in Kiddushin. Rabba Bar Bar Chana gave money to Rav and instructed him, buy this land for me. But he that would be Rav, went and bought it for himself. So there's the classic case of the poach. But did we not learn what he did is done, and yet he has behaved toward him as a cheat? Okay, so stop right there. So elsewhere in the Talmud, right, there's a law about behaving as a cheat. The word for cheat is rimai, and the word for wicked is rasha. What is the difference between a cheat and a wicked person? The Gemara does not tell us which one is the worse of the two. Does anybody want to hazard an opinion on this? And I won't say a guess, because there really is no answer here.
It seems to me that a cheat is one type of a wicked person, but they're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah. Well, okay, how about this? If you're a wicked person, you're evil, and society can deal with you. But if you're a cheat, you pretend to be trustworthy, but you are not, you could make the case that that is more damaging to society. Right? If I know you're evil, I won't do business with you. But if I don't know that and you steal from me, and you could do that from everyone. So they make an example of Pharaoh, that Pharaoh was a rasha, but Lavan was a cheat. You can use this for Passovers coming up. And it says about Lavan that he tried to uproot everything. And that's kind of why he's the villain. So that's just a way to think of it. Okay. Consider the case of somebody negotiating to buy a house, and the two parties agree to a price and are about to close the deal, and another party jumps in and gets the house. The interloper, or the poacher, is called wicked because the interloper should look elsewhere. So this is the justification, that the interloper has options. Why interfere with someone else's business deal that they've been working to close? The interloper, in the view of the Talmud, can find another house to purchase. However, on the other hand, before the two parties have agreed on a price, why shouldn't another person be allowed to jump in and make a bid?
That's not all the time, obviously.
And that also makes the assumption the interloper knows either or both of the other parties.
Why would that matter? This is a business offer.
If you're offering to buy Stu's cow,
right,
for $100,
right,
and I come in and I offer you $105, and I have no idea that Stu's bidding, you know, offering $100.
And what if you do, by the way? You are making a business deal with me.
Stu may
be a great guy, but we don't kind of care about his feelings, do we?
Before the deal is closed,
it's open.
It's still open. Okay. Once the deal is closed and you come and say, I know you made the deal with him, you shook hands, but sell it to me for more money. That's where it becomes questionable.
Right.
So let's go back to the story here about Rav. Right, so Rav was instructed to buy the land and he bought it for himself. So the question being asked is, why is he not a cheat? And the answer, well, it was a stretch of land belonging to lawless men. For Rav, they showed respect, but they would not for Rav Bar Bar Chana. So the tough guys, like Rav, they would never have sold it to him, so that justifies Rav. No, so he asks a further question. Then he should have informed him, meaning Rav should have gone back to Rav Bar Bar Chana and say, here's the deal. And the answer is, he feared that in the meantime, another person might come and buy the land. So the question I ask you is, what's the tone of this argument? So, did Rav do a good thing or not? Well, maybe, but it seems to me the tone here is apologetic. Right? Why, they're trying to say, why shouldn't we call Rav a cheat? And they're saying, well, he wouldn't have sold the land to him, and he didn't have time to go back and find out.
But why didn't Rob just sell the land to Rob Barhana for no profit?
That's another question. I do not know. It's not an alternative, you know, given in the text.
Because he could have been a shaliach and bought the land in his name and then turned around and sold it.
Well, so you could have made the case that... Well, he actually, I take that back. He has Rabba Bar Bar Khanna's money. It's not his money.
Oh, I assumed he used his own money to buy it out from...
It says he gave money to Rob.
Right, but when you said, but he bought it from...
So presumably he's going to return the money. You're right.
Because otherwise he bought it for Rabba Bar Khanna.
Because in Stu's scenario, all he would have to do is say, here's the deed. I did as you expected.
Right. Yeah,
they thought they sold it to me, but...
Right, and the text does say he bought it for himself.
He bought it for himself. So I inferred from that he left Barhana's money sitting on the table and used his own money to buy it for himself.
I inferred that he totally cheated and just stole the money from Barhana and used Barhana's money to buy it for himself.
So here I would say...
But then he's not buying it for himself.
Don't forget, Rav is a great man, so the Talmud is not going to be very condemning of him.
In other words, if someone gives me money to buy something and I don't tell the person buying them that I got the money from somebody else, I just take that money and give it to them.
But you're still buying it on behalf of the person that gave you the money, though. Even though the seller doesn't know you're representing someone else, you're representing someone else. I guess it comes down to how you interpret that himself line.
No, he bought it for himself. I think it's clear.
Well, to me, that means with his own money.
That's the
yeah, I would assume.
It's not that's clear because
it's not theft. He didn't steal the
money. Right. So he must have given.
We're assuming that he gave the money back because
he left it on the table.
Or left it on the
right,
table.
That's what I'm assuming.
Okay. But my question is, you know, his logic here is they would deal with me. They wouldn't deal with Barhana.
Right.
So why didn't he just buy the land with Barhana's money and give Barhana the deed?
Maybe if he moved in, the bad guys would, you know, like run their motorcycles by all night. They didn't like him.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when he moved into like bad neighborhoods.
I think there's a lot of after the fact. What's the word I'm thinking of?
Justification.
Plus, you know, I hate to sound like this, but how would you feel if you were Barhana?
I would feel cheated.
You wouldn't feel very kindly towards Roth.
No.
Yeah.
All right, so let's read another story in this. Rav Gidal was negotiating for a certain field, and Rav Abba went and bought it. Thereupon, Rav Gidal went and complained about him to Rabbi Zeira, who went and complained to Rabbi Isaac Napacha. Wait until he comes up to us for the festival, he said to him. Immediately making you think of Star Trek, Landru, the festival.
Mm-hmm.
Does it resonate with anyone? when he came up and met him, and presumably they're all in town for one of the holidays, pilgrimage holidays, he asked him, and here we see the line, if a poor man is examining a cake and another comes and takes it away from him, what then? He is called a wicked man, was his answer. So presumably he's saying, you know, you're wicked, you're the interloper, you are the Rasha. Then why did you, sir, act so? He questioned him. Okay, now I think we're going to see parallel from the beginning story at more length here. This is all rationale. That's the word I'm looking for. He said, I did not know he was negotiating for it, he rejoined.
And that's my point.
Okay. You can't say that in the first case because he gave him the money to buy the land. So here he didn't know because here he just apparently popped in out of his own volition.
He's a victim of circumstances.
So now we have the Mantell solution, which is, then give it to him, he suggested. Aha! I will not sell it to him, because it is the first field which I have ever bought, and it is not a good omen. But if he wants it as a gift, let him take it. Now, Rav Gidal would not take possession, because he found a proof text, he that hates gifts shall live. In other words, don't look a gift rabbi in the mouth. Nor would Rav Abba, because Rav Gidal had negotiated for it. And so neither took the possession, and it was called the rabbi's field. And apparently it just lay fallow forever.
Yeah. I wonder where that field is now.
It's a multi-million dollar condo on it. Okay, so that's more of the same. So now we're going to get into the dispute over this. And we start off by looking at very famous Mishnah. This whole section of the Talmud with people who find things, they find it together, they so on. So this is a case. So person A sees an object in the street, presumably a ownerless object, a $100 bill, and he falls on it, or he covers it up with his coat, because that's how you lay claim to something. And person B comes along and takes possession of it. Who owns the object? And the Talmud is very clear on this. The one who took possession of it acquired it. Even though the other guy saw it first, even though the other guy put his coat over it, the guy who took it gets it. So this is the Jewish version, and maybe it's even the source of the common law, which I don't know is really real law. Possession is 9/10 of the law. Right? In Judaism, to acquire something which is called a kinyan, you must physically do an act to it. So if it's something you buy, you lift it up. Or if it's a cow you're buying, you pull it with a rope. And that determines ownership.
So the man who fell on it just fell on it and hadn't done anything to it yet, so somebody else came along and picked
yes.
it up.
Yes. So you would say here...
The person fell on it, touched it.
Right.
No, well, he covered it with his coat or something.
Right, but why would he do that?
Oh, but falling on it is not taking possession.
But right. Why would he fell on it and grabbed it? I mean, why
wouldn't he... If he grabbed it, then...
Why wouldn't he grab it?
Maybe he wasn't fast enough. Or maybe he just covered it with something. But I mean, they do give you that option.
Maybe it was too big for him to lift, and he went to get his son to help him.
Or he thought it was covered, nobody would see it, so yeah. It was safe.
Right. So, the inference here is, whoever makes the deal owns the property. Right? This is going back now to these stories about the guys buying the land. It's kind of a justification. Did the person who actually give the money and acquire the land own the land? And that's what the Judaism would seem to say.
What about the whole discussion we had on agency?
Yes, this is not agency. Well, so in the first case, it would be. You're
so
right.
So you're saying you can't have agency in terms of land, in terms of acquisition?
You can have agency in terms of acquisition. So that's a good question. I guess that's... It doesn't come up in the sources I've seen, so I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you. Okay, so now we have Tosafot, who are Rashi's grandsons, or French commentators, who are very expansive and kind of technical, and you'll get a sense for how they work this. So they're going back to this story. The poor person turns their cake, and another comes and takes it. The person who takes it is called a wicked person, a Rasha. So Rashi seems to be saying the opposite of what we just saw in the Mishnah. Rashi explains that this refers to a cake that was ownerless. However, this is problematic, because as we just learned, if you found an ownerless object and fell on it or covered it, and another person comes and takes it, then the one who belongs, it belongs to the one who took it. Similarly, and there's a long discussion about this, that if poor people are gleaning in the field, and same deal, they put their coat over it or something, but another poor person comes and takes it, who owns the gleanings? It's the person who took
it. Yeah, but this is saying a person turns their cake.
So right.
The person is actually doing something, whether it's theirs or not, they're doing something to, they're turning it, like on a griddle, they're
so
turning it over.
The turning the cake is just, it's kind of a euphemism, it's a saying, and it's not quite clear what it means, but this is how it's understood.
Yeah.
Someone's poaching something from a poor
right.
person.
Because I see turning their cake as like a pancake or a tortilla. You cook it one side on a hot stone or griddle, then you flip it over.
Right, right. But that's the question, you see, the question they're going to ask here, which we'll come back to in a second,
Why is this different?
Is it ownerless or is it owned? Because that makes the difference.
Right.
So Rashi is saying it's ownerless, it's hefker. But along comes Rabbeinu Tam, and he says the prohibition to take the cake from the poor person is only applicable specifically when the poor person desires to profit from the wages, or when he or she wants to purchase one item and another preempts and purchases it, like in the case of Rav Gidal. And that is why he is called a Rasha, because why should he go for something his friend is taking the trouble to obtain? So let's go back and explanation on this. So again, Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam are disagreeing on whether the ruling applies only to commerce or also to, and there's two other categories here which I'm not going into detail about, gifts and found objects that are ownerless. So Rashi believes that the poor person turning the cake applies to both business as well as anything else that is ownerless or a gift, is hefker. Rabbeinu Tam disagrees.
I'm confused.
Yeah.
Because the presumption that it's ownerless says that somebody can come along and take it.
Yes.
Which goes against the original statement that says the person who takes it is wicked.
Yes. Well, no, because we have conflicting values. Because the Mishnah says you can take it.
That's right. So, right, the Mishnah says you can't take it. And Rashi is saying that the cake is ownerless, therefore you can take it. Therefore, that goes against the idea that the person who takes it is wicked.
No, Rashi is saying that he is wicked.
Even
though it's ownerless. Saying, yes, he's going with that. Rabbeinu Tam is in the other category.
Similarly, it also...
The principle of turning the cake...
We may remove that poor person from the... Similarly, is a poor person falls from the...
Rashi goes along with the definition of that's up in the front.
Okay.
A poor person turns a cake and another comes and takes it is called a Rasha.
Okay. So Rashi is saying that and Rabbeinu... Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So Rabbeinu Tam disagrees when it comes to a lost object or something ownerless.
Okay. So he's agreeing with the case before where the guy, you can take the money. Okay.
Right. Why? He says, because with ownerless property, you can't tell the second party to go elsewhere and find a similar object. For example, if someone sees a $100 bill on the street and is about to grab it, another person has the right, according to Tosafot, to push him aside and take it first. You can't tell him, why don't you look around for another $100 bill? Because it's rare to find a $100 bill in the street. So that's his understanding.
Here's the thing that I'm losing. I am a bread maker.
Your
I'm
mind.
A cake maker. Okay?
Yeah.
I put my cake on the griddle. I turn my cake over, to use the Mantell theory, and I turn my back to go get ready to make another cake.
Right.
My cake is not ownerless.
Right.
My cake is not watched at the moment, but it's not ownerless. I own it. So how does it become an ownerless cake where Rabbeinu can come in and just take it?
So I agree with you.
I don't think that's the case we're talking about, because that's right. Out and out theft.
Right.
Well,
I was going to say, we don't understand the phrase fully, but it must apply to, like, if you're doing this in the street, and then you walk away to buy a pack of gum, and the cake is sitting there. It's presumed ownerless. In the bakery, it's not presumed ownerless.
Okay, but if I walk away from my car to go get something,
right.
My car is not ownerless.
No. No, but I have to think about it. I don't know that it's the same case because the cake, I want to say the cake is common, but he's making the argument here that if it's something rare, it's not common. So that may have something to do with it.
I think that a car in the street is more common than a cake in the street.
Well, to be practical, you couldn't steal the car because you don't have the key. And if the car is locked, you can't get in. If it's unlocked, you still can't drive it away.
But I also think in the context of modern society, we all presume that a car is not ownerless.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you saw a $100 bill on the street, you might assume that's ownerless.
Yeah, maybe a better example would be, right, you go by someone's house and there's a kid's toy out on the lawn and it's night. And you think, what's this doing here? You could consider it ownerless or lost or something.
Well, if it's on somebody's lawn.
I would assume it's a lawn owner's child's toy.
Or maybe the wind blew it there.
If you find it on the beach, let's stretch it out a little bit.
Sooner or later, we'll be justifying Fort Knox. So what's the halakha, you wish to know? So we turn to the Shulchan Aruch, and it says, once a buyer and a seller have reached an agreement, another person may not interfere with the deal by offering a competing bid. One who does so is labeled by the Talmud a Rasha, a wicked person. And although a Beit Din cannot cancel the purchase if this person succeeds in buying it, the Beit Din is permitted to publicize this person's action as being immoral. So the question is the Shulchan Aruch agreeing with Rashi or agreeing with Rabbeinu Tam?
Kind of taking a middle ground there.
Absolutely. He's citing both opinions in one answer, right? He's added this thing. I mean, he agrees that whoever takes it wins. That's theirs. And he agrees that that person shouldn't do that because it's a wicked thing to do. But then he comes and adds this thing about the Beit Din, basically saying, you know, you can put up a sign at Borough Hall saying, so-and-so is a thief, don't do business with him. And that's okay.
What about the seller here? If it's known, if it's wrong for the wicked person to come in after they've agreed, right? They've reached an agreement.
I would think it's on the seller, not on the second buyer.
The seller is just making a contract with whoever has cancelled.
He's making the contract.
But he's already made a contract. Correct. And then if somebody comes along with a better offer, he
can't. Oh, no, he can't do that. And it says so explicitly.
He doesn't have a contract yet.
They have reached an agreement. Another person may not interfere by offering a competing bid.
Right, but one who does so is labeled a wicked person, and the Beit Din can't.
So what they're coming on the fact is, if someone does that, the deal is still legal.
Right, but what I'm saying is they're labeling.
What I'm saying is, why isn't the seller also
labeled? Exactly.
I would say that's just what the law is.
Yeah, but because the seller, the seller is more.
From the point of view,
the seller's worse.
At least it's not worse.
Yeah,
right?
because. The person that bought it at a higher bid can't always say, well, I didn't know that they made a deal. But the seller does know.
Yeah, the seller.
But the seller could also come along and say, you haven't done kinyan with your item, so technically I still own it, no matter what I signed.
Yeah, right, but still he's
I'm trying on that one.
The seller in this case is breaching a contract.
So this is good. So there's a discussion that follows this, that there are a number of limitations to this. So I'm just going to read quickly some of them and see if our thing comes in. Firstly, it only applies to a buyer and a seller that have reached an agreement about the sale, including the price, and are at the stage of preparing to finalize the actual purchase. If the parties are merely at the stage of negotiation, others are free to make a competing bid. Furthermore, the prohibition was enacted to protect the first buyer from losing the deal, but it is not intended to work against the detriment of the seller. And so if the seller himself wishes to solicit offers from other parties, they may make their bids for the deal.
But that's before an agreement is reached. If everybody is still placing bids, then an agreement hasn't been reached.
And now I'm not going to read it, but I have a whole page of, it starts getting into the weeds about the price, and there's a minority opinion. And I think I wanted to say the takeaway, which I'm going to say over and over, is this is a gray area, right? This is in a place where you don't have a legal recourse, really only a moral recourse, and that's what the law is trying to steer you towards. Yeah, they had another thing here about what if, and now we get into these property deals, but if you want to sell the house next door, should the neighbor get a say in who moves in? Because he's going to have to live with them.
We'll see next.
So there's lots that goes on there. All right, and we're going to see similar things now. So that's commerce. Now we go to dating. And here we have a story that actually precedes the material that's in Kiddushin on the first page. It starts off this whole thing. Ravin the pious went to betroth a certain woman for his son, but betrothed her for himself. Interloper, poacher, same thing. But was it not taught? What he did is done, but that he has behaved toward him as a cheat? Mind you, so the betrothal is kosher. It's good. And you can't undo it. So, once again, just like we saw before with Rav, they start giving excuses. They, the family, would not have given the daughter to his son. That's the excuse. Okay, then Ravin the pious should have informed his son first. But he feared in the meantime another man might come and snatch her away. So, right, it's the same story again.
The son capable of betrothing her for himself, or the father has to do it for him?
No, the son is capable, I assume. I mean, I assume he's old enough. If he's a minor, then maybe not.
Yeah, but I'm just curious why the father was...
He's just being a snake.
He's doing it. No, the father was going after the children on behalf of the son in the first place. The son is capable of doing it, so...
Okay, so commentaries. Many commentaries believe that ani hamechapek becharara does not apply to dating, since when it comes to ownerless property, you are permitted to interlope. Thus, a preemptive move in the case of marriage is not seen as worse than in the case of jumping in to claim an ownerless object. The Aruch HaShulchan, citing the opinions of the Tur and the Shulchan Aruch, makes this very point that marriage is not worse. It's very strange language. Then the case of gifts or lost objects, where the interloper is not considered a rasha.
Okay. So the interloper is okay?
They're trying to make the point that marriage is in a different case here. So the rule might not apply. And here indeed is the very Aruch HaShulchan. If someone appoints an agent, there's your agent, to betroth the woman on his behalf, but he went and betrothed her to himself, she is betrothed to the agent. However, it is forbidden to do so. This is just like the property. And whoever acts in this manner with respect to dating or commerce is a rasha. So he's saying the turn the cake does apply here.
So he's an evil person, but the marriage,
but the marriage holds.
Is still valid.
Yes.
So similar principle.
Yeah. See, we have to go back to talk about agency again, I think.
Right, this is, correct.
Because this is...
Steve Nagel's expertise.
Because I thought that the agent, when the agent speaks on your behalf, he can't...
No, it's a good question. I mean, I wish we had phone rabbi where we could get an opinion on how the agency affects this.
www.askmoses.com.
No, we need a real live hookup. We need FaceTime.
They're live. They chat.
I know. Okay, this is codified by Maimonides in the Mishnah Torah. One who sends an agent to betroth him to a woman, and he goes and betroths her to himself, she is betrothed to the agent. Nothing new, we understand that. It is forbidden to do this, we understand that. And all who does this thing, and similarly in matters of business, is called a rasha. So,
and you can hang up a big sign.
Rashi is putting in that this does apply to both business and dating.
But can you still hang up a big sign saying this person's a Rashi?
Just to show you, well, in one case, the Beit Din can do this stuff.
Yeah.
Just to show you how relevant things are, I think this is fascinating. So, turns out that this exact situation is dealt with by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, the 20th century, and I thought you would like to hear what he says on this. So this is something that would apply to people our age. Feinstein asserts that if two people are simply dating, the rule of ani hamechapek b'charara does not apply. Dating is no different than commerce, where if two parties are discussing a sale and the price has not been set, another party has the right to jump in and purchase the item. Only when a price has been decided is the interloper considered a rasha. However, if the couple have decided to get engaged, but have not formally done anything yet, which is, you know, a formal ceremony of betrothal or a gift or something to make the deal, A God-fearing person should act stringently and consider the opinion of Rashi. Rabbi Feinstein indicates that the Rima, that's the Ashkenazic commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, accepts the opinion of Tosafot that the issue of Ani HaMechapek does not apply to an owner's property and gifts, and therefore should not date the girl. Okay, so that's real life for you. Now we come up to the third case of interloper.
I really want to read that whole case. I mean, that would be very curious.
Well, for Feinstein?
Yeah, the Feinstein case. I mean, that sounds like a really... Somebody was dating a woman and somebody else came in and...
I think you'd find it's almost pretty much this exact language. Because that's what these guys do.
Yeah.
I just find it fascinating that this is, you know, people who mock what's the 2,000-year-old legal system. It's very relevant today.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like it. I don't agree with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think like we said before, the seller in the commerce side is getting off too easy. As far as the dating goes, if a man and a woman are, I mean, it depends if the father is involved also finding the match for his daughter. If a guy's just not, you know, closing the deal, you know, getting engaged or whatever, somebody else comes along, that would be...
Well, interesting what this is saying is that it doesn't matter if they're engaged, it's still the betrothal.
So betrothal is really engaged.
No, but stand correct.
No, but that's a really good point, because it's not quite the same as what we do today.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it exactly lines up.
In the Orthodox world, they still do.
Well, but betrothal is just engagement. That's all. We get, you know, today we get engaged and then we get married. I mean, we call it betrothal, the actual wedding ceremony in modern English. But it's really the same process.
Not quite. No. Betrothal is done at a wedding ceremony.
Yeah.
But in the ancient world, they did a betrothal and then a year went by. Right. And then they did the marriage.
Right.
However, once you are betrothed, you're effectively married, meaning if you break the betrothal or you break the engagement, you need to get a get. It's a serious thing.
I didn't know you needed a get for breaking an engagement.
Oh, yeah. You are absolutely married once you're betrothed. So today, what they do is the ceremony you see for a wedding is really a betrothal followed by a wedding. And the actual marriage does not take place until they go into seclusion.
Right.
So even when they're marching down off the bima, they're technically still not married.
Right.
Well, in Jewish law,
in Jewish law,
in Jewish law, civil law, they are.
But you're betrothed.
No.
No, you'd still need a get, but you're not married. Yeah, it's a little complicated.
Well, because you need to, in Jewish law, that's the consummation is everything.
Yes. Yes, the seclusion. But just as a physical step of the wedding, that's what it is. All right, so third case, employment, right? What if you're an employee and you're an employer and you're making a deal with an employee and someone comes and snatches him or her away? Is it the same thing? So now we turn to Bava Batra, which is all about civil damages and things. Rav Huna said, if a resident of an alley sets up a handmill and another resident of the alley wants to set up one next to him, the first has the right to stop him because he can say to him, you are interfering with my livelihood. By the way, that is halakha today.
Yeah.
And if you want to open up, let's say, a kosher restaurant in a town, and the certifying authorities don't think the town can support two kosher restaurants, they can deny you a certificate of kashrut. So this is a very real thing.
Interestingly, that happened when Giddy's opened up.
Yes. Right. That's why he had to be far enough away. Same thing with Lynn's when they were in Manville.
Mm-hmm.
That it wouldn't affect either business. Now, this is where it gets fun. May we say that this view is supported by the following? So we have one of those ancient sayings that people knew. Fishing nets must be kept away from the hiding place of a fish which has been spotted by another fisherman the full length of the fish's swim. And how much is this? Rava, son of Ravuna, says, a parasang. Okay, which is a unit of distance.
Like a parsec.
It's actually equivalent to a league, a European league, and it's based on the distance a military person can march in a day, some fraction thereof. So it turns out to be about 4 miles, in case anyone is interested. what are they saying? That the fisherman knows where the places the fish congregate and puts the bait, and if he puts his bait too close to an existing one, the fish will go there and eat the first guy's bait, and the second guy will then lose his fish. So he's intruding again once on his livelihood. Now, so the fisherman knows where the hole he places. It's not even English, I don't know what I wrote. And if another does, he is poaching on the preserves of the first. But can you say this of someone who sets up an opposition mill? That's the question they're asking. This indicates that one must distance himself from the place where another has established a business. Gemara responds, this is no proof. And I didn't read the last line, which I will read now. Why is this not a proof? Fishes are different because they look about for their food. In other words, fish don't work like people do. Fish are constantly darting around looking for food. Now, the theory is one fish will go ahead and look for food sources, and when he finds them, he'll signal all the brother fish, who will then follow him to the food source. So once they encounter the first one, they won't go to the second one. That's the argument he's making here about the mill. It's a little sketchy, I have to admit.
One fish, two fish.
So let's go, let's move along to this long discussion about this. So now again we have the Tosafot who are commenting on this. The question arises, however, from the case of Bava Batra, where the Gemara says one must distance themselves from the fish as far as they dart. It seems that the reason there is because you are encroaching in your friend's livelihood. And the Gemara says, one is permitted to object to someone in the same alley putting up a bill next to his, because he can say, you are interfering with my livelihood. Moreover, said Rebbe Meir, Rabbeinu Tam's father, the fish mentioned here is a dead one, because it was the way of fishermen to place dead fish in their nets to attract all the local fish to their nets. And now they're going to do, when the Talmud wants to talk about anonymous people, they call them Reuven and Shimon always. So that's just, they're just place names for people. And since Reuven was the first to cast his net, and due to his efforts, all the fish were bound to collect around his net, if Shimon were to cast his net, it would be akin to stealing from him. And thus Reuven is entitled to tell him that he must go and fish somewhere else. So, I'm not sure how this all adds into the story about employment, but the basic method is that a person is not allowed to interfere with another person's earning a living, is what they're getting to.
It seems anti-capitalistic, right? And capitalism figures that one should be able to hold whatever business, and it's competition and whoever.
I think you're right about that.
Well, not necessarily, because you can... It's more antitrust than anything. I mean, you can still set up your mill, you know, down the block. You can't set up in the same alley. Because you set up in the same alley, you could be blocking people from going through the alley to the first.
Right. And they talk about that.
Okay. But just, you know, and with the fish, I mean, it's a big lake. You know, you could, or the Sea of Galilee, for instance. You can go someplace else to cast your net.
A parasang.
Parasang away, which is 6 kilometers, by the way. It's 4 miles, 6 kilometers.
So the other thing, Lawrence, that I'm just speculating here, you could also argue that if the town cannot support two mills, so both would go out of business, and the town would be poor, so the rabbis and
the better mill
I have to admit, this is like socialism.
Not not both would go out of business. Presumably the better one would stay in business, and the woman go out of business.
Yeah, but if they were the same, neither could afford to stay.
Right.
But in either case, you're right, it's still not capitalist, because then you have a group of elites deciding who can make a living and how.
I don't know that they were necessarily capitalists back then.
No, that's well, that's
no,
also true.
That's a modern sensibility thing.
That is true. That is true. Okay, let's go to a special case here, which is more obvious and more direct. No dead fish. From here it seems to Rabbi Yitzchak, that's Rashi, that it is forbidden that a teacher, this is, I don't know how I came with this English either, to hire himself to the owner of the house who already has another teacher in his home, as long as he teaches in his home. Since he is a day laborer, he being the second teacher, the teacher can go elsewhere to earn a wage. However, if the employer informs him that he no longer wishes to hire the first teacher, then he can come and compete for the job. However, in the event the employer hires a teacher, another employer is permitted to bid for his services, and the first employer cannot demand that the second employer hire a different teacher, because the second employer can say, I only want this teacher, since my child will learn more from him.
So, yeah, it's a capitalist example.
Well, it's all, yeah. So the question is, what happened to the leniency? What happened to the rule about not interfering with someone's livelihood?
But that's not his livelihood.
It doesn't seem to apply when it comes to teachers.
Well, no, because it's not the teacher's livelihood is not affected. It's the consumer that's being affected.
The consumer is making the choice here. That's why I said, here comes your capitalism. The consumer is
No, but he could use the fish argument and say, go look for a job down the block because this one's already taken.
But now the other party of the contract is saying, I'm not interested in this contract anymore. I don't want you as a teacher, I want the other guy.
But there are two cases here. That's the first case is where the teacher tries to horn in on a first teacher.
Right. That's not the one we're arguing.
All right, the
second case, we're talking about the second one.
Is where you have two employers bidding for the same teacher.
Right.
Correct.
And there you're allowed to be competitive.
Correct.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So, the Shulchan Aruch says, here's the law from the Shulchan Aruch. It is prohibited for a teacher to hire himself to a householder who has another teacher in his house, unless the householder says to him, I don't want to keep my present teacher. But if the householder hired a certain teacher, another householder can hire that teacher for himself. So that's the halakha.
And that only relative to teachers?
Okay.
No, because I can imagine where the author of the view learning as something so important, different that they have the rules for it.
You win the Jew of the Night Award.
Right.
So there is a leniency when it comes to teachers. Why? There may be reasons a teacher of Torah is a unique case, since the essence of teaching Torah is to explain concepts and delve deeply. Every Torah teacher is different, so finding the appropriate one is akin to finding something extremely rare. Since every teacher explains Torah in a different manner, it is not like having two of the same items. Another explanation for the leniency is that since this is a matter of a devar mitzvah, a thing that is used for a mitzvah, it is permitted. So apparently, finding workers is analogous to acquiring ownerless property because people are different and not interchangeable. That's the argument they're making.
But isn't that also denying the first person the mitzvah of learning Torah?
The first teacher?
No, the first person.
Or the first employer.
Employer.
No, because he's hiring a teacher.
He wants to hire, but now the second person comes along and hires him away.
Oh, it takes him away.
So you're impeding that person's fulfillment of the mitzvah.
I guess the argument is there is you can find another teacher of Torah.
But so
it's just
a
some are, but some are better than others.
Yeah, well.
So there's the competitive thing. So strike the blow for capitalism.
Hmm.
Now, once again, just to show that this is very current stuff, we have a Rabbi Fleischman whom I know nothing about, but I presume he is current. A worker who is unable to find another job in the city is permitted, according to the majority of authorities, to offer an employer his services even when the employer already has another worker. The reason for this is that the work, under such circumstances, is considered as ownerless property which cannot be obtained elsewhere. And according to most authorities, the prohibition of turning the cake, therefore, does not apply. Okay, conclusion from all of this. What makes the case of Ani HaMechapek B'Charara unusual is that this is a case where Jewish law attempts to move the boundaries of the law to make people do more than the law requires. One might argue there is nothing wrong with cutting in a business deal if a contract has not been signed. Some business people might see the interloper as being clever and astute and a good business person. Talmud, however, wants to build ethics into the law. And that's really what I was saying all through this, in the nub of it. There's the law and there's kind of what's right, and it's really struggling into the what's right area. Although the interloper has successfully snatched the property away, he is punished with public humiliation. That is the worst possible punishment in a case where the deal has not been legally finalized. It also goes without saying that a rasha will be punished in the afterlife. Jewish law demands that one be ethical and go beyond halachic legal requirement. And this is derived from a verse from Exodus: "You shall instruct them about the statutes and the laws, and you shall make known to them the path in which they should go and the work in which they should do. You shall do what is fair and good in the sight of the law." The concept of doing fair and good provides the Talmudic sages with the legal ability to use their judgment and demand more than the strict letter of the law demands. This is reminiscent of the system in Old English law known as equity. Courts of equity, I never heard of this, as compared to courts of common law, dealt with unfairness and injustice that arose because of the strict application of traditional law. We don't have that in America, do we? Or ever did?
There's no distinction between the law. There's a concept of law, of equity, but there's no distinction. There's no separate courts for it.
There's no court for it, okay.
There's usually separate courts, court of chancery and a court of equity, and which would be a court of equity, and courts of law. But now they just have separate courts. Except in Delaware.
I think that's very interesting. So finally, there's another modern-day scholar posits that the sages of the Talmud used Agadah, the non-legal side of the Talmud that contains narratives and maxims, as a device to enhance the law and make it more value-based rather than rule-based. The bottom line is that obeying the letter of the law and not cheating or stealing is insufficient for a God-fearing person. The Talmud sees going beyond the requirements of the law, lifnei meshurat hadin, which literally means inside the line of the law, as a Torah requirement. Indeed, Jerusalem was destroyed for following the strict letter of the law and not doing more than the law required.
Yes.
Yes,